Welcome, everybody, to the White House, or what we like to call the People's House. I wanted to point this out because from the very beginning, the President, First Lady, and everybody who worked in the administration has tried to make this the place for Americans. From celebrating Heritage Months to hosting our first Eid event, to bring all types of music, to bring the Japanese-American World War II veterans to honor their service, to bringing refugees to the White House, to designating an internment camp in Hawaii, a national monument, the People's House has truly embodied what the President sees as the American we live in. My name's Elisa Koh. I am the Senior Associate Director here at the White House, and my main job here is to work with Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. I have a long thank you list because this event wouldn't have been possible with so many of you in this room. So I want to first thank, of course, the Japanese American World War II vets for their service. We truly appreciate you for coming, and all their families who have traveled across the country to be here. Allison and Allison and the Japanese American National Museum, Bill and Gary at JACL, Petra at and the Arab American National Museum, folks who put on the National Youth Summit earlier this year, Christine and the National Veterans Network, team at Allegiance, and so many of my colleagues, Julie, Menar, and Ivana, who has helped do all the logistics, really thank them. When we were trying to imagine our last AAPI event at the White House, we reflected about the work we did in the last 8 years, and the people and the stories. We remember the stories we heard at the mosque visit and roundtables from MASA students about being bullied. We remember the stories from students that were trying to organize on campus, college campuses, and being told that Asian wasn't a minority by their administrators. We remember reading about the hate crimes at mosque, reading about the Asian American New York Times editor being told to go back to China, and watching the viral video about my lunchbox moment. We were also reminded about a significant anniversary coming up, the 75th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor bombing, and pretty soon, the Day of Remembrance, a day commemorating the Japanese American incarceration during World War II, coming up in February. With all these themes that we were trying to encapture, I heard a speech this last weekend and read a friend's Facebook post that captured what we were truly trying to do today with this event. First, it is important for storytellers and people to hear about stories and learn about history, so you'll hear a lot from storytellers today. What does it mean to be American? What are our rights? What are our responsibilities and obligations? When do we speak up? The President talks a lot that he doesn't see a blue and red America, but the United States of America. And I still hold that to be true. There's a common thread of what it really means to be American. We have built this country together, warts and all, and we will continue to build this country together. Today, we'll hear from a lot of stories from folks on the stage, but we want to hear from all of you. So please reflect, listen, connect. I appreciate from the bottom of my heart everybody that's come out and made this event possible. With that, I would like to introduce my co-MC for today, David Ono. I first saw David's work at a live stream with the National Youth Summit and saw his documentaries. He has conducted many interviews and about this topic and about World War II, so please welcome David.
Thank you so much. And an absolute honor to be here. I'm from Southern California. I work in Los Angeles at the ABC station there. So it's wonderful to come and see some new faces, some old friends here, and talk about this story, this chapter in history, how it relates today, and how vitally important that it is. So I want to begin by asking you a question. Have you ever been scared? I think we all have. And we know what it's like to be scared. Overcome with fear, where it's all that we can think about. So we've been there before. So think about 75 years ago, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, immersing this country into the most brutal war this world has ever seen. These are frightening, tragic, horrible times, times so fearful that we actually trampled some of our own brothers and sisters with the thought that it would keep us safe. So think about that. 2 months after Pearl Harbor, Franklin Roosevelt demonstrated a president's enormous power by signing an executive order. It was called 9066, the 75th anniversary is this coming February. A simple signature forced 120,000 people of Japanese descent, the vast majority American citizens, to be ripped from their homes and thrown into American concentration camps. This country called them potential spies, saboteurs, soldiers in waiting, when in reality they were kind, law-abiding, patriotic citizens who loved this country. There wasn't a single case of espionage in this entire population, not a single case, yet they all were sent into camps, sent into prisons. So part of the beauty of being an American citizen is we have what's called the Fifth Amendment. Due to due process, we cannot be locked up without being given a chance to prove our innocence, yet this country ignored that for these Japanese Americans. Fear caused Americans to look the other way. I had the remarkable opportunity to interview a woman from this generation. Her name is Toshi Ito. So today she's over 90 years old. She stands far less than 5 feet tall, but she's wonderful. And when she talked to me, she's holding back tears, telling me about her family and the hell that they endured. She, along with her mother and father, were forced from their Los Angeles home. She says they were put on a train to where they didn't know. After 3 long days, the train stopped, they got off, and where'd they find themselves? A desolate place in Wyoming. It was called Heart Mountain, where they would spend the next 3 years behind barbed wire and machine guns. She tells me that the hate for Japanese Americans was so fierce that after the war, when she moved back to Los Angeles, her parents would drive out of their driveway and run over tacks that people threw in the driveway that punctured the tires. She said her grandmother would go to the grocery store, and at the grocery store would be told she can't buy her goods because she's Japanese. She would have to take a train to Chinatown and pretend she was Chinese in order to feed her family. And they lost everything. Her father couldn't get a job. They said, we won't hire you because you're Japanese. He was an insurance salesman, and a really good one at that before the war. But after the war, they sold their car, they sold their file cabinets, their adding machines, they sold everything of value. And the only thing they had left was a life insurance policy. So Toshi Ito's father committed suicide in order to provide for her family. It was his final act, his final commitment to help them. And by the way, Toshi Ito is the mother of the Honorable Lance Ito, the judge who presided over the O.J. Simpson trial. So being in Washington, I can't help but think of Secretary Norman Mineta, the first Asian-American mayor of a major U.S. city, that is San Jose. He's also the first Asian-American cabinet member under President Clinton. He is also appointed to a second cabinet position under President Bush. And Mineta was only 12 years old when he and his family were incarcerated in a concentration camp, so he knew firsthand what it's like to be racially profiled. In 2001, the irony of ironies, he was transportation secretary when 9/11 hit. He was the one in charge when the U.S. had to land all the planes and then come up with a plan to keep everybody safe. And in this high-profile meeting with the president and a number of other people, he recalls the president saying this: we will not racially profile Muslims and Muslim Americans and repeat what happened to Norman during World War II. It was a telling moment. And even then in 2001, if you knew history, you knew what was brewing in this country. Muslims and Muslim Americans are kind, law-abiding, hardworking people who are as entitled to their pursuit of happiness just as any of us are, and just like the Japanese Americans were during World War II. So yes, these are fearful times, but we can't let that fear trample our fellow Americans and change who we are. To do so is cowardly. In 1988, President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act. It granted reparations to Japanese Americans who were locked up, but also, and perhaps most importantly, apologized on behalf of the United States, apologized. And by the time the letter of apology went out, George H.W. Bush was the president who wrote that letter, and here's a snippet of it. It says, words alone cannot restore lost years or erase painful memories. Neither can they fully convey our nation's resolve to rectify injustice and to uphold the rights of individuals. We can never fully right the wrongs of the past, but we can take a clear stand for justice and recognize that serious injustices were done to Japanese Americans during World War II. Anyone who thinks that Muslims should be labeled, rounded up, locked up, or out should read this letter. They should swallow their fears and become a courageous American, because Americans fight for the rights of all citizens. All men are created equal. Isn't that what we say? And that is who we are. Those are my thoughts on this chapter in history. And I left one very important part out because we have a video presentation we're going to show you. But President Obama, he proudly awarded the Congressional Gold Medal to the 100th 442 MIS. This group of remarkable soldiers, and we have a few with us here today, for its size and length of service was considered the greatest fighting unit in American history, and it was made up of Japanese Americans. Many of them had families that were locked up in these camps, and yet they fought for this country. They died for the United States of America. Here's a video that we produced that literally sits over that Congressional Gold Medal at the Smithsonian Institution's American History Museum.
This is the Congressional Gold Medal, awarded to one of the greatest fighting units in military history. Brave warriors who unflinchingly dove into battle during World War II, no matter the odds, men who bled and died for their country. But that's only part of their story. They're known as the 100th Infantry Battalion, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and the Military Intelligence Service. As was policy at the time, they were segregated units of Japanese Americans called Nisei, born in the United States in Hawaii from immigrant parents. What's remarkable, they fought while many of their families were unjustly locked up in American concentration camps, dying on the battlefield for the very country that did that. These brave men called it loyalty. They believed fighting and dying for the United States of America would allow their families to live a more normal life, a life of acceptance.
Like the 100th Sadao Munemori, who courageously fought through some of the toughest battles in the war. On April 5th, 1945, a live grenade bounced off his helmet and toward two of his comrades. Diving on top of it, Munemori smothered the blast, saving his men at the cost of his own life. Months later, the picture of his mom he always kept with him was returned to her, now stained with his blood. He would become the first Nisei in history to be awarded the Medal of Honor. 442nd's Daniel Inouye from Hawaii found himself face to face with three German machine gun nests. Shot in the stomach, the leg, and losing his arm, he fought on, silencing all three nests, earning him the Medal of Honor. This great warrior survived to become one of the most beloved senators in American history. Kan Tagami's dangerous covert world of the Military Intelligence Service had him sneaking through the jungle with a handful of brave men, within earshot of the enemy, using what he heard to help guide his men out of danger. After the war, he would become General MacArthur's right-hand man and the only member of the occupational forces to have a private audience with the Emperor of Japan. Thousands of individual stories of bravery and sacrifice, accompanied by great humility. Men who fought fiercely through Italy, France, Germany, the Pacific, and then dealt with hate at home. By the end of the war, the 100th 442nd was the most decorated unit in American military history for its size and length of service, and the MIS is credited with shortening the war by 2 years due to their remarkable ability to stay a step ahead of the enemy. As President Harry S. Truman welcomed the Nisei home, he said,
"You fought not only the enemy, but you fought prejudice, and you won."
An exceptional group of young men, forever a symbol of courage that goes far beyond the spilling of their blood, whose depth and sacrifice, combined with absolute modesty, are now embodied in this Congressional Gold Medal. In one of my interviews in a previous work, my favorite interview was with this gentleman named Edward Kananika. He lives in Brières, France. Old man now. But during the war, he was 17 years old, and he worked for the French Resistance. And he tells me the story of how one day he was given the top secret duty to sneak into the forest and to find the 442 and lead them into this town, because this town had basically had been overrun by the Nazis. So he had heard of the 442. He heard that they were one of America's greatest units. So he snuck into the forest. He found them at their location. He envisioned giants. But he said, what, I found Asians. Little Asian men, he said. 5'2", 120 pounds. But he said what was remarkable was the courage in their eyes, their steely resolve, how they said, all you have to do, lead us into town, and we'll take care of the rest. And they did. So I love that chapter, and I love hearing that about these incredible men, because you're about to meet one. They are filled with honesty and humility. They never talk about themselves. They'll never tell you, you know, the great things that they've done. Toshikazu Okamoto, Tosh, he's about to come up here and speak. He's a Nisei. He was in the 442, and at the age of 17, he joined the all-Nisei 442 regiment and was stationed in Italy towards the end of the war. And he did this, like many others, while his family was incarcerated in the camp. He had his dad, his mom, his brother and sister all in the camp while he put his life on the line. And he has been an outspoken person when it comes to this chapter in history. He served as a member and former commander of the executive board member of the Nisei Veterans Committee, co-founded the Seattle Care Road Nursing Home. He resides in Seattle, but here he is today to talk to us about this incredible chapter. Ladies and gentlemen, meet Tosh.
Thank you, thank you. I want to really thank Christine Yamamoto that helped set this program up for us veterans, as well as some of you volunteers that's looking after us here, and as well as the JAVA Veterans Association here. But anyway, we're very grateful that you people have stepped up and honored us this afternoon. My name is, as David mentioned, Tosh Okamoto. I was born in Seattle and still live there. I've been married to my wife, Toshiko, for 67 years. I have 4 children, 9 grandchildren, and 7 great-grandchildren. So it's really a good time in my life. I retired from the Seattle Fire Department as a mechanic and supervisor after 32 years. My family was interned in Pinedale, California, and then on to Tule Lake, and we ended up in Heart Mountain, Wyoming, as some of you folks here did. I kind of can relate to the story of Ito, Miss Ito, that David just spoke about, where our experience was pretty much the same. We got on this train in a place called Renton, Washington. We didn't know where we were going, and when we were boarding the plane, of course, there was soldiers with guns waiting for us to get on. During this period of time, we were ordered to keep our blinds down, so we didn't know where we were going at all. The only signs that we were going someplace was it kept getting warmer and warmer and warmer, and we ended up in Fresno, California at the Pinedale, what they call the assembly center, and we call the concentration camp. Then from there, we went on to the Tule Lake concentration camp. And there was, as you probably heard, many of you, that there was a real controversy when the government came out with this loyalty questionnaire. My family, my father had married twice in his first family that he divorced. Those children, their mother took them to Japan, but they all came back before World War II, and they were called the Kibes. And of course, when that questionnaire came out, me and my oldest brother, my father had a heart attack, and so my oldest brother, the Kibe brother, he felt he was ahead of the family, and he wanted to make sure that I didn't sign that loyalty oath. Well, I was determined to sign that loyalty oath. As soon as I became 18, I was going to volunteer. But unfortunately, my father had a heart attack, so my mother didn't want me to volunteer. But in any event, ultimately I was drafted, but this difference between my half-brother and myself, that loyalty oaths and not signing that, it just it was a family problem all my life and all his life. Of course, as some of you know, they did what they thought they didn't, and this time my life, looking back, I can't be blaming for what they did. They did what they thought they should do, and we veterans of the 442nd, we did what we had to do. But that relationship between my oldest brother was never, never very, very good or very, very tight, so to speak. But anyway, I think time in our community, our Japanese American community, I think drove us closer together. I think we all agreed that when you're prisoners of some place and had the same experience, like these gentlemen here, you know, we're buddies because not only because we're in the Army together, but because we're Japanese Americans. And so we have this very, very tight relationship. Unfortunately, many of my old comrades are in our 90s now, so we're all going to a better place than maybe where we are now. But in any event, I didn't want to speak too long and take up too much of your time, but I want each one of you to know that I really appreciate you folks being here and listen to our story. I think it's very, very important. In Seattle, currently, we have teamed up in partnership with the Holocaust Mercy Center in Seattle. And of course, that's, many of you know, that's a Jewish museum, and the Consul General of Japan, and the Nisei veterans, and we're working together to enhance the story of the Holocaust. Of course, that's a main topic, but many people know quite a bit about the Holocaust, but they do not know anything about how a Japanese consul in Lithuania signed a lot of passes so that those Jewish people could escape Europe, and I think they're talking about 6,000 people that were saved because of this Consul Sugihara. And so that is part of our story attached to that Holocaust. And as many of you know, especially the veterans, the 522 Field Artillery, they were part of the 442nd. They were the first American soldiers to discover the Dachau concentration camps. And they did what they could when they discovered, but they were told, they were ordered that they were never to speak of this. Because it sounded like the Army, our Army, still had this discriminatory feelings for Japanese Americans. Because what makes us feel that way is when the 442nd, as David knows, was ready to enter Rome, well, they were pulled back, and another Caucasian units were got the glory of rescuing Rome. And so those are two distinct signs of racial discrimination. But in my time in this world, I still think that this is the greatest country in the world. You know, we right wrongs like the redress that David talked about. And looking back in the history of our nation, the discrimination from the Civil War on has always been towards people of color. But now it's getting much, much better. So I feel good about our country. We got a long ways to go, but God bless America, and God bless you for listening to me. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Next, we have a spoken word piece from Nikiko Matsumoto. She is a farmer, artist and community leader. She also started the Valley Storytellers Project as a means to create a public space in the Valley to tell their stories. She'll be performing an excerpt from her play, What We Could Carry.
I am humbled and honored to be in this room today. And I come with a message of solidarity from the Central Valley of California, a special message from the Islamic Cultural Center of Fresno. Their director, Reza Nekumanish, reminds us to stand together, not only in tough times, but also in good times, so that when the tough times come around, we're that much stronger together. I'm going to perform just two voices from a play, What We Could Carry, that I created based on testimony from real people. Like our speakers earlier today. These testimonies are from a congressional commission that was formed and traveled around the country in 1981 and 1982, holding public hearings at which hundreds and hundreds of Japanese Americans came forward to tell their story, many for the first time ever. This is for them. This is for my Jichan and Bachan. This is what we could carry. Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of this commission, my name is Sally Kirita Tsuneishi. My father, an immigrant from Kumamoto, Japan, settled in Kohala, Hawaii at the early turn of the century. As a scholarly gentleman, he became the president of our Japanese community, the Japanese school. He was our town's newspaper reporter for the Hawaii Hochi, and he was an official matchmaker. A Baishakunin. He was highly respected. On December 7th, 1941, the whole world was shocked by the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And as for us, we were filled with a terrible fear. That night, an FBI agent with our town sheriff appeared at our door in the middle of the night to arrest my father. Without a word of protest, my father got up, got dressed, and went with them into the dark night. We did not see him again for 2.5 years. About a year later, family members of these interned were ordered to evacuate. The army authorities never told us where we were going. We just blindly obeyed. I can never forget the day the army trucks pulled in front of my home. Because we were singled out, I felt an overwhelming sense of shame. We were no longer part of the community. We had become outcasts. As we drove past my high school, I saw the American flag waving in the wind. And an awful realization dawned on me. I thought of the prize-winning essay I had written for my English class entitled Why I Am Proud to Be an American. As tears streamed down my face, I realized, yes, I am a proud American, yet I have the face of the enemy. After a long voyage across the country, we arrived at Jerome, Arkansas on January 5th, 1943. Because I lived on the edge of camp, I lived under the shadow of barbed wire, the high sentry tower, the armed guard. After months, my father had still not joined us as was promised to us, and we were very concerned for him. At the age of 16, I had assumed the role of head of the household, for my mother neither read nor wrote English. I was granted permission to visit my father, held at a prisoner of war camp in Camp Livingston, Louisiana. As I waited at the guard tower, I was shocked to see my father, stoop-shouldered, aged beyond his years, walking slowly toward me with the help of a cane. After 2.5 years, my father was returned to us broken in health and in spirit. I cried out in my heart, How could you do this to us? My name is Bill Shinkai. I'm gonna be 45. I was 5 years old when we were in Manzanar, and as young as I was, I do have memories of it. I remember the first thing we did. I remember filling these mattresses of straw. I remember the barracks. There was nothing in them but the beds, the cots, and we were assigned. We had to share with another family. I remember the windstorms, the terrible food, the loneliness, and, well, I know it was harder on my parents than it was on me. In 40 years, people talk about, why do we bring this up 40 years later? You know, people in our community work. You know, work. We have different political viewpoints, different values, different beliefs. But somehow or another, I have never felt closer to these people, to my people, than ever before in my life. In 40 years. People talk about being let out of camp in 45, 44. And 43. I don't think we ever did get out of camp. I think we're beginning to get out of camp now. Thank you.
Thank you. Great job. Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Next, we have a discussion between a son and his mother, two absolutely charming people. First, you're going to meet Paul Takamoto. They're both from the D.C. area. Paul is a spokesman for the Federal Aviation Administration, and he's the son of Alice Takamoto. But Paul, he confessed that he was a rebel growing up, you know, an angry young man. I don't know if angry is the right word. He can clarify that for you. But he was able, as he grew older, to channel that energy and to help spread the word about this fascinating time, this fascinating generation that his mother was a part of. His book, Nisei Memories, My Parents Talk About the War Years, is a book that chronicles how his parents weathered the disruption and the violence of the war. So he's going to join us up here with his mother, and together they're going to talk. Alice Takamoto is a survivor of World War II internment camps, of course. She was detained first at the Santa Anita Assembly Center with her three sisters, and then she was reunited with her family at Jerome, a concentration camp in Arkansas. And I've met them before and heard them talk, and Alice, you are adorable and wonderful. And Alice also, she probably is the type that will never tell you, but she's a highly respected pianist, and she continues to be active in the DC area playing classical music. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Alice Takamoto and Mr. Paul Takamoto.
Test, test, test.
Yeah. Hello? Okay, I think the first thing I want to say, other than the fact that I'm very nervous, is that talking to my mom about what happened to her during the war is something we didn't start doing until I was in my early to mid-40s, and I'm 58 now. I was born in D.C. and raised in Maryland, and at that time there was no diversity, and I didn't ask anything about her past or my father's. He was in the 442nd because I didn't want to know. I was not proud of being Japanese American. I just very quickly wanted to just provide a quick thumbnail sketch. Both my grandparents on both sides came from Japan for the same reason that most people come to this country. They were in a desperate situation. They wanted a better life. And I really can't put words to the bravery that it would take to leave all that you know for all that you don't know, except to say that when you demonize people for doing that, you're over overlooking a very basic fact that they want to be here. They want to be in this country. They want to be proud to be in this country, and they want to be accepted. Acceptance for my parents' generation ended when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, which is kind of the worst possible scenario, I would think, where the country you left attacks the country that you went to. And in my father's case, in Hawaii, they attacked his home state. He was a student at the University of Hawaii. And he ended up volunteering and eventually was a combat medic in Italy. And he had a Bronze Star, two Purple Hearts, and in retrospect, clearly undiagnosed, untreated post-traumatic stress disorder, lifetime of depression, anger management issues. On my mom's side in California, her parents, stop me if I get any of this wrong, Mom. Her parents were arrested shortly after Pearl Harbor. My grandmother, who lived to be 105, and who is, when people say, who's your hero, she's the first person that comes to mind, because I've always felt that if a lack of bitterness and self-pity is a sign of strength, then she's one of the strongest people I've ever known. And she's kind of like that, too. But when I talked to my mom about her experiences, she went to the Santa Anita racetrack. She and her three sisters, because her parents were arrested, were left to get rid of everything they owned, including their dog and their house and everything. They went to the Santa Anita racetrack and lived in a horse stable while the more permanent camps were built. And then she ended up in Jerome, Arkansas. When we finally started talking about this, I sort of knew all of these events in sort of a hazy backdrop sort of way. I knew that my mother and many of her generation didn't like to talk about it. I wasn't sure why, but she told me that she blamed herself for that, which kind of floored me. So I thought I'd start by asking why you felt that it was your fault. You were 15 at the time, right?
Well, I think maybe because my father was arrested by the FBI and my mother was arrested by the FBI, and then we were going to leave our friends, our school, or my dog, and the community, and then go into camp. And I thought maybe we did something wrong. Why are we sent away? I was only 15, and those just were my thoughts.
I mean, maybe we could say real quickly, and I'm sparked by what we were talking about earlier before, about it, just very quickly about what the principal of your high school did, because the thing, one part of the Japanese-American experience that I feel is underrepresented are the actions by non-Japanese-Americans to stand up for these people who are being persecuted. And when it's, that to me is one of the definitions of bravery, when you're doing something that's going to immediately isolate you from everyone else because this herd mentality developed. So, and we didn't rehearse any of this, we're not professionals or anything, but would you mind telling them about your principal?
Well, when Pearl Harbor came and we were just fearful. The next day at school, we went to school, and it was a Monday, and the principal had a special assembly. And I remember this to this day, that he said, we are not the enemy. And so all of this leadership came from the principal, and we were in that high school until that following April when we were sent to camp. But there was not one incident of any harassment from any of the students. And I think about the Muslims and other ethnicities that are being harassed right here in Montgomery County, in the schools that my grandchildren went to. I'm just so fearful. I feel the pain of these students. And I just
Can you describe what you felt like at the time when after Pearl Harbor, what the feeling was like for you?
Well, we were still at home. It was just fear. We were at war, and you know, I've never been anywhere where we were at war, and of course, because we are Japanese, we were considered the enemy. And as far as I could see, there were many people in the leadership that stood up for us. I recall that with the churches, the individual churches in our community did. I think that the American Friends Service, the Quakers, were one group that really stood up for us.
Can you guys hear okay in the back, by the way? Oh.
Okay.
Did you have a sense that when you guys were forced to go into essentially prison camps, did you feel that this isn't right, what's happening to us?
I can't say that we even thought about that. You know, we were just thinking about getting our clothes together. We had to only take what we could carry. And we just really didn't think about the next day. We just took one day as it came.
Well, one of the things that you told me that also sort of I found very dismaying is that you didn't feel, I can't remember how you put it, but you didn't feel comfortable in your own skin until you were 70?
Yes. I was in camp for 16 months, and that was really my junior and senior year in high school, which I felt that my high school really didn't amount to much, and then I was totally unprepared for college, which I did go to. I was only 16, I was shy, I was small, and I had a limp at that time too, and I was very self-conscious. I didn't talk to anybody, and nobody asked me about camp, and so I really felt like an outsider for the total 4 years. People were very, very tolerant, but I wouldn't say that I made very many friends. And in that sense, I felt as though I was an outsider.
I think just to give everyone the proper perspective, this woman used to be very tough, and she has actually, when I was little, I remember being dragged through the house by the ankle so she could... She'd have my head under her arm, and she'd be unwrapping the bar of soap in front of my face, and she'd shove it in my mouth. Because what David was talking about earlier, I was in trouble all the time. But that's a little off topic. I just want you to get the full, you know, this is... So what do you think changed over time? And you have to talk directly.
Well, I think
pretend
you know...
Pretend it's a bar of soap.
I think that along the way there were many people that helped me through my schooling and afterwards, and I was lucky enough to have a family and children, and to be able to combine my career with the family and still be at home while they were growing up is a luxury that many people can't have right now. And my aim, I think, was to raise two kids to be responsible and be very responsible as adults. And so, you know,
that's where the soap came in.
So I've achieved that, and so I feel very lucky. I feel that I have, and it's taken me about 70 years to realize that.
She's 90 now, by the way. What would you have to say to two people who today who are being bullied?
Oh, I just feel their pain. I think it's even worse now because there's this social media where falsehoods can just be transferred so quickly. And it's just coming, there are so many incidents of harassment right now, just in a week's time or a month's time, that it's different. It's I think it's worse. I have fear for everybody. And I hate to say that, but I just feel as though the young people that are being harassed, they haven't done anything wrong. They should realize that they haven't done anything wrong.
Oh, Lisa said that we had time for questions if anyone has questions.
Your father. I understand you're saying that your mother and father were both picked up earlier than the rest of us. Is that correct?
Yes, they were both language school teachers. Yes. There were only about, as far as I know, maybe 33 women that were arrested. And not too many people know about that, but my mother was one of those few. So she spent 3 months at Terminal Island in California. My father was a prisoner of war. He was interned in New Mexico, so he was away from us for about 12 months. Yes.
I mean, I would just add to that that a lot of Japanese American communities were centered around churches and things like that, and it's to me it's heartwarming to see that same thing happening with other ethnic communities in this country, because I think it's a very crucial part of passing on your heritage to the next generation, which frankly was a heritage that I rejected, because she was in the Japanese American Citizens League, and we would go to these in Montgomery County, Maryland, on these beautiful sunny days, there'd be a basement full of young Japanese American kids who would rather be anywhere else than there. But I regret that now. But
I think we have another question.
Paul, I think you can expect a soap dinner tonight. my question is this. Given how you described your father's what happened to your father at the early, right after Pearl Harbor. And I think you said he volunteered for the 442nd. Do you have any insight as to what motivated him to volunteer?
Proving their loyalty.
Yeah, it was a matter of proving their loyalty. He was a student at University of Hawaii. They actually had to spend, they weren't allowed to join right away. They had to spend a year in what was called the Varsity of Victory Volunteers. They did road work and that kind of thing in Hawaii. And after that year, then the United States government decided that, yeah, we should let these guys volunteer. But he told an interesting story about when they were cleared to be allowed to volunteer, two of his friends got in an argument over whether Japanese Americans should volunteer or whether they shouldn't, and the argument between these two guys got so heated they went outside, and my dad and his other buddies had to go outside because these guys are going to get in a fight. And as it turned out, the guy who said it should be a requirement ended up not going into combat duty, and the guy who said no, it's up to everyone's will, he ended up going, and he ended up getting killed.
Rare wealth of knowledge in the room.